Microphone's off on this side too, right? I mean, in a sense, it's not being recorded. Good evening. Tonight, we are fortunate enough to have Terry Hunt of Associated Press, the senior White House correspondent, who we were supposed to have a little earlier, but we got snowed out. We now have a very nice spring day. And we are fortunate to have Terry because he has a long view of the presidency. He's seen many different presidents, and he also knows how the Washington community works. And so he can tell us a lot about the White House press corps and covering the White House. Welcome, Terry. Can you tell us first about how you got to the White House? Let's trace your career before you came to Washington.
Okay. I worked for the Associated Press in Louisville during college. Mm-hmm. I was a summer intern for the AP. Got drafted and went away for 2 years, came back, worked for them in Louisville, transferred to Providence because I said I wanted to work in an ocean state. And so they sent me to Providence. I was there for 2.5 years. And this is while Watergate was broiling in Washington. So after about 2 years, I asked them to send me to Washington. And thankfully, they did. And I came in April of 1974. And as you know, Nixon resigned in August of 74. So it was really a tumultuous time. Of course, I was the most junior person in a staff of about 120 reporters. So I did not play a key role, but I was on the sidelines, and I got to see a lot of this stuff. Probably my most exciting thing at the time was riding out to Andrews Air Force Base to see Air Force One land and see President Nixon get off and get on. We had to staff Air Force One every time it moves just to make sure that there's no accident. So, as I said, I was kind of on the sidelines of that. I was an editor. I worked on the desk for about 6 years to earn my stripes as a reporter. Back in those days, you had to put in a lot of time at a desk. And finally, I got to cover the United States Senate. And then I was asked to do one trip with Ronald Reagan because for some reason they needed somebody to fill in. The regular guy was not available. And I was a backbencher at the time. I mean, I still had not, made much of a mark in Washington. And I went out on this trip with Reagan. We went to a place called Grand Island, Nebraska. And he had already made the major news of the day. And there was a late night event. He did a question and answer session with people, some little community group. And somebody asked him about how he thought that veterans were being treated, Vietnam veterans. And he said that he thought it was a shame that Vietnam veterans didn't get the GI Bill because Vietnam was not a declared war. Mm-hmm. Well, I had been in the Army, and I knew that Vietnam veterans did get benefits. So I went up to his people, a guy named Ed Meese, and said, you know, that was wrong. You want to correct that? And they, no, he stands by what he said. So I phoned in an urgent that night. I said, presidential candidate Ronald Reagan, an obvious misstatement, said Tuesday night that Vietnam veterans didn't get benefits because Vietnam wasn't a declared war. And it caused a big stir. Mm-hmm. And the VA director came out the next day and denounced Reagan. And it magnified what was an inclination of his to distort facts. Mm-hmm. Like there's more oil in Alaska. He would say that more oil in Alaska than Saudi Arabia. He just made up things. Mm-hmm. And so this caused such a stir that I got a little bit of notice from my editors, and they said, well, he's going to go out again next week. Do you want to go with him? And I did. And I never got off the campaign trail after that.
Uh-huh.
And then when he won, I followed him to the White House.
What was their attitude to you, towards you, for having known that fact and brought it out?
Well, I thought they were naive. They were naive in the way they treated it. I mean, they should have known that I worked for the Associated Press. And when I put something on the wire, it's going to go to 1,500 newspapers in the United States and all around the globe. So, I mean, it has a big impact. It has a punch. Mm-hmm. And they underestimated that, or they thought that it wasn't that big a deal. Mm-hmm. And instead, within 2 days, Reagan had to apologize. He stood with some lieutenant general or major general at his side and mm-hmm. said that he was wrong, but, you know, he tried to clarify it. But it became became emblematic of these misstatements that he was making at the time. Uh-huh. And I know that Newsweek or Time, one of them, did a big story about all the, you know, Reagan goofs. Mm-hmm. So it was an embarrassment for them. They were irritated with me for a while, but they got over it because there are more irritating things that happen in a campaign than just me.
Yeah. When you were on the desk, what kinds of things did you do on the desk, and what sorts of things do you learn from it?
Well, coming in from, I worked in Louisville and I worked in Providence, Rhode Island, and you come into Washington and you're not prepared for the culture here. I mean, it's so vastly different than what I was used to in Kentucky, certainly, and in Providence.
In what ways?
You know, just handling the knowing what inflation is, and, you know, editing copy, and mm-hmm. all the economic terms that come out, you know, the unemployment reports. The learning what all the different agencies are. You know, you're dealing with copy that comes in from the White House, the Supreme Court, Congress, the Pentagon, every place, and it's an intense learning experience. I thought it was a little bit too intense in that it went on for so many years for me, but I couldn't get off the desk. But I think that it was helpful in that it provided you with a foundation about the way that Washington works, that you learn, you know, how Congress works. You learn mm-hmm. about what a conference committee is. You learn, you know, just how the Congress interacts with presidents, a president of the same party, a president of a different party. I mean, you see these things, and you absorb this knowledge over time, mm-hmm. and it gives you the perspective that I think is helpful when you write your own stories.
Right. So when you get to the White House, you're pretty well seasoned, and you know, an AP correspondent knows what to look for.
Should. I mean, we don't bring in anybody. Nobody comes in as a new reporter. I think I was 35 when I started at the White House, and I had been in Washington for almost 10 years. Mm-hmm. A little bit less, but you know, it's certainly not a first assignment in Washington. You work at a couple different things. You work the desk. You work another beat. I mean, as I say, I went from mm-hmm. a long time on the desk, and then I went to work on the Hill on covering the Senate, and that lasted for 2 years. And as I say, this was just kind of a quirk that I wound up on a presidential campaign. I probably wouldn't. I asked to cover politics that year, and they said no, not yet. Mm-hmm. So it was just an oddity that I did make it.
Uh-huh. Do you think that when you, you work on the desk and you develop some specialties, particularly some understanding of economics and maybe foreign policy, that having that background, it provides you with threads so that when you come into a White House that you can pull those threads and look at how things are done. You can look at the decision-making process, like taking a foreign policy issue and seeing, you know, who's really involved in it.
Right. And, you know, if you cover the White House, they say that, you know, you have to be a mile wide and an inch deep mm-hmm. because there are so many things. You know, one day you're dealing with the Middle East. I mean, you're always dealing with Iraq. You know, now this week, White House reporters are dealing with Latin America. You have to go into these kind of a crash course in what's going on. You know, what are the issues in Latin America? Before a trip like the president's on right now, reporters will go around like to different think tanks. They have specialists who you can go talk to, and they have seminars. And I know a lot of White House reporters will go and talk to them. Mm. But you always have to, I mean, there's immigration, economics, taxes. You have to know about so many things, and you have to stay alert to what's going on, things that are happening across the river, say at the Pentagon, could easily wind up at the White House. Mm-hmm. So you have to be attuned to all these things and things that are going on around the world. Mm-hmm. So, you know, you pick up as much knowledge as you can. It would be, I think, you know, I was upset that I spent so much time on the desk, but I think if I had come in to Washington and just been dumped into a reporting slot mm-hmm. prematurely, that it would have been a disaster. Mm-hmm. I have seen that. We have done that with some specialties. We brought some people in and done that, and it hasn't worked well.
Mm-hmm. It would seem that that with as many different issues that there are that a White House deals with, that it would have the advantage in dealing with reporters.
Well, they certainly know more than we do on the issues, mm-hmm. and they know absolutely more about what they're doing. Mm-hmm. I remember that Marlon Fitzwater, who was the press secretary to Ronald Reagan and to 41, he once got angry at us because some reporter said at a briefing, well, you know, I'll tell you what's going on in the Oval Office. He said something. And Fitzwater said, you don't know 90% of what's going on in the Oval Office. Mm-hmm. And I thought that was really sobering. I thought, boy, we sure don't. Uh-huh. You know, as evidenced by things like Iran-Contra and, you know, different things that have gone on, you find out how little you actually know.
Mm-hmm. Did you all ask him to improve on the percentages for
you? Oh, absolutely. Yeah, but I mean, you know, so White Houses are steeped in secrecy no more so than this one. I mean, this mm-hmm. one has made an art form out of that. And it's just so difficult to get information.
How do you do it?
Well, you work it a bunch of different ways. One is you talk to people inside the White House, but a good way to do it is you talk to interest groups mm-hmm. outside the White House, because the White House has got a vast constituency that they have to deal with. Like, say, on a Supreme Court nomination, they talk to different conservative groups, they talk to Right to Life groups, they talk to, you know, right. a bunch of different groups to make sure they kind of vet their candidates with their mm-hmm. constituent groups. So what you want to do is you're talking to the constituent groups. You know, you cultivate them and talk to them and see what they're hearing. Now, a lot of times, you know, like particularly on an extremely sensitive thing like a Supreme Court nomination, they might not have the absolute word. If one of them told me, mm-hmm. you know, it's this person, I wouldn't go to the wire with that. Mm-hmm. In fact, that happened the day that John Roberts was nominated. People were saying, different interest groups were saying it was X or Y, and it turned out not to be. But you get it, that's where you collect the string that you're talking about. You mm-hmm. get information, and then you take that and you go to the White House, or, you know, you go to the people that you talk to in the White House, and you bounce stuff out off of them. I can't think of, hardly ever does it work that you just call up somebody and say, hi, can you tell me something? Mm-hmm. I mean, just randomly. You have to bring something. It's like, I'm hearing that X is happening. I'm hearing that Y is happening. Or we've been told that by people on the Hill that the president's going to do this. And mm-hmm. then you've got some negotiating room. You've got a little bit of leverage, a little something to deal with. But when you come empty-handed, you don't have much.
Uh-huh. What would they typically say if you say, I'm hearing that, I don't know, I'm hearing that that Wilson, that Joseph Wilson has a wife who's in the CIA.
Well, that's kind of, they might say, let me hold on, Carl wants to talk to you. Or let me put Scooter on the line.
Yeah. I think they would now hang up.
Yeah, exactly. It depends. I mean, it depends upon the sensitivity of the information. If you have something, and they know that you are you're pursuing a story, that you've got some stuff, they have to assume that you're going to continue along that line of thought somewhere. You know, many times they'll try to be helpful, mm-hmm. Up to the point that they want to be helpful. I mean, they have boundaries and limits of what they want to give out, and they're very disciplined. They're mm-hmm. very, you know, they've got their talking points, and sometimes they'll talk up to that, maybe go an inch further. But, mm-hmm. you know, it's no guarantee of success. But if you don't have anything, chances are you're not going to get anything.
Uh-huh. Well, they say, if you say, we are going to publish X.
And that's a trick. That's an old trick. Right?
And then they say, well, you'd be making a mistake if you do that. Would a press secretary be the most likely person that you could go to for that kind of thing, where they'll warn you off of something?
That's, you know, that is such kind of a such a well-known mm-hmm. device that some people sometimes they'll do it, you know. But if it's something that they don't want to play on, they'll say, you know, look, you're gonna have to make your own decisions. There are ways out of that. They can uh-huh. say, you're going to have to make your own decision, or I'm not going to take responsibility for that.
Uh-huh.
I mean, I've tried that, and, you know, there are many tricks like that. But we're about to put this on the wire. I've got two sources. Mm-hmm. Sometimes it works, but with this crowd, because they're so tough, they're more inclined to say, well, you're going to have to do that on your own.
Mm-hmm. Scott was talking, McClellan.
Scott McClellan.
When he was press secretary, was talking about some of the ways they gave out information. And he said that sometimes what they would do is they would give Associated Press a story, because especially if it's going to be a story that's, I think, a bad story, that you all are going to give the most objective view, but also it's going to be short so that you can't put a lot of other things in it. So you can have some commentary from other people, but it's not going to be, say, as long as the Washington Post story might be. And that once that story comes out, say the Washington Post runs it, and if they run it, then they're less likely to do a story on their own on it.
Mm-hmm.
Now, but you say that's true.
Well, I don't. The benefit to a White House of giving a story to the AP is that it equalizes it. It gives it to everybody at the same time.
Uh-huh.
It doesn't give an advantage to, say, the New York Times, the Washington Post. If you've got a story that you want to get out, we get it to 1,500 newspapers, every radio and television station in the United States. It goes up on every major website, 500 news websites or news-connected websites. You know, we're the primary news source for Yahoo, AOL, MSNBC. So when we send a bulletin or a news alert, something like that, everybody sees it immediately.
Mm-hmm.
So if they have something they want to get out, like on a well. I don't want to go into anything particular, but if they want to get anything out, you know, I encourage them come to us.
Uh-huh.
Because, you know, there's nobody who has a broader reach, a faster reach than the AP.
Mm-hmm.
So in terms of papers don't like to follow another news organization. So if they do give it to us and the Post is running or the New York Times is running, there probably is less likelihood of a follow-up.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, it's already been out there. So, that you know, maybe that figures into there.
Uh-huh.
If you look at, Lanny Wiles wrote a whole book on strategy that the Clintonites used.
Oh, Lanny Davis?
Lanny Davis on the strategic methods of leaking and
uh-huh.
different things that they would do
uh-huh.
to diffuse if they knew that... like today, they knew that material was going to be released about the firing of the prosecutors and the White House involvement in it. So stories appeared in the Washington Post and the New York Times with the White House perspective on it. The White House got in on that story before its publication, told its side of the story, so that when the Times and the Post came out,
mm-hmm.
that the White House had a pretty healthy... representation, their voice was there, mm-hmm. instead of having the Democrats or somebody else who would have obviously spun it a different way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I mean, when we were not involved in the early part of the discussion of that story, but, at midnight last night, our reporter who was with the president in Mexico got to Dana Perino, And she had a whole set of talking points that she was willing to talk about.
Mm-hmm. In the Clinton administration, they did that with the fundraising information that they were going to be getting up on the Hill that had been subpoenaed. And so they gave it all out beforehand, and by the time the hearings came about, nobody was interested in covering that.
Right. They thought that that would diffuse the interest in it, or that, and that it would they would take, they would have their spin on it, rather than coming out of a opposition Congress that put its spin on it. So it's part of the strategy of, you know, that's part of the strategy of leaking, and why you have to be careful about dealing with the way you deal with leaks.
Yeah. But it seems like this is the first time they've done a document drop that I remember. But, different party control.
I was going to say that's the big difference here.
For different methods.
Right. You've had a, the Bush administration has had a compliant Republican Congress for the first 6 years. So there's been very little oversight. You haven't seen the kinds of things that we're seeing now with the investigations and the Democrats probing into things that, you know, and we're just in March. So who knows where this is going to go, but the administration, the White House, did not have to answer to Congress very much at all in the first 6 years. And it's only now that they're having to snap to attention and deal with the Congress.
The administration has talked from time to time about the importance of the new media and how the old media is just going by the boards. In fact, Karl Rove gave a speech at Texas State University, I guess a couple of weeks ago, in which he was talking about the new media and I guess they have visions of newspaper bureaus kind of going out of business. While there's a lot of attention on local press, and say on local press and blogs and other things, it seems that blogs get their information from sources such as Associated Press and from the newspapers. And if you look at the local level, they're carrying your stories. For example, when the president issued his energy proposal early in his administration, I happened to be in College Station, Texas, and I read it. And I read the story about the energy proposal in the College Station Eagle, and you were the author of the story.
Good, good to hear.
This week, for last week, when the Libby conviction came down, I was in Texas and read the Dallas Morning News, the Houston Chronicle, and the Austin Statesman. And all of them ran the New York Times story.
Oh, I'm sorry to hear that.
Yeah, well, sorry. but it's local really isn't local. And what do you think about that? And that approach that there's the new media beats out the old.
Well, you know, I thought that one of the most interesting things was when Hillary Clinton announced her presidency. She didn't come out and hold a news conference. She announced her candidacy on the internet, which was unthinkable, you know, 4 years ago. And did she follow it up by coming walking outside of her house and having a news conference in? No, she did nothing that day. Everything
was hung. Saturday too, wasn't it?
Yeah, and everything was hung on her internet appearance. And John Edwards prematurely announced his candidacy on the internet. He was supposed to have a news conference, on a Friday, but instead they inadvertently put up their website that had it. So the internet is playing a huge role in the transmission of information. For us, our focus is we're turning a lot to the internet because, you know, we are the primary provider of content for all of these news websites.
Yeah.
You know, they talk about the dead tree industry, the newspaper industry, that is, you know, in trouble, is losing circulation. People of college age aren't reading newspapers. You know, they're going on the internet. I've got a daughter who is a junior in college, and she doesn't read the newspaper, but, you know, she goes online and reads the news. So, you know, that's why newspapers are beefing up their websites.
Mm-hmm.
But, I mean, there's still, somebody's got to provide the content for the news, and local news, as you say, is very important. I mean, that's why a lot of people read papers or are looking for information. There's no reason that they can't have, you know, right now, have a newspaper and a website. I think practically every newspaper has a website. I looked, the president was interviewed by five Latin American journalists before he took off. And I checked in all the papers in Guatemala, every place he went, all these newspapers had websites. I mean, it's not like it's just, wealthy countries, but poorer countries, struggling countries have websites along with their newspapers.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, it's just, it's a, you know, an evolution of the industry and the way things are heading right now.
How is Associated Press doing with all of these changes? Does it help you, hurt you, come out neutral?
I think it helps us because we are not dependent upon, you know, we don't have our own newspaper.
Mm-hmm.
What we're hooked into is every newspaper and all of the websites that didn't exist, you know, 10 or 15 years ago are now major sources of revenue for us. So as maybe newspapers decline, the websites increase.
Mm-hmm.
And we have, we sell a whole array of services, you know, financial, sports, news, to all these websites. And I think that the fastest growing source of our revenue is the websites.
Mm-hmm.
So for it hasn't hurt us. I mean, it's certainly good for us, and we're moving pretty aggressively in it. I mean, I don't know that when we're going to get to the point that reporters are, you know, carrying a camera on their hat or something like that. But, we're moving very aggressively into the digital, streaming video.
Uh-huh.
We've hired, I think we've hired four online people in the last year. And 5 years ago, we had none.
Mm-hmm.
So it's all, the movement is that way.
Mm-hmm.
Toward the web.
Mm-hmm. Thinking about how reporters do their work and White Houses do their work, and one thread that we've gotten recently of looking into the Vice President's office and looking into the White House itself is the Louis Libby case, and there are a lot of documents that had exhibits that were up on the web actually.
Mm-hmm.
And that I found really interesting.
You sent me a link to.
yeah, that's right. Yeah.
I asked you.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, I wanted to talk to you about them. Well, I guess one of the things that surprised me was how much energy was put in by them to try to get back at Joseph Wilson and to discredit him and to discredit through discrediting his wife's having sent him, trying to imply that she sent him on a junket, although I don't think going to Niger it's not like going to the Ritz-Carlton
Paris
But were you surprised by the way they were giving out information and the kind of relationships that reporters seem to have with their sources, with those people?
I think that that was the fascinating thing about the Libby trial was how much it kind of like peeled back the wraps on this White House, which is we've talked about this, it's been so secretive. There have been political charges that the White House is this or that, but the testimony in the court, the sworn testimony, provided a much more graphic picture. And even like Ari Fleischer talking about it, provided a very graphic picture of how the White House worked and the documents. Documents showed that. So it was a fascinating portrayal, and that was unvarnished.
Mm-hmm.
If you take everybody at their word, I mean, and I don't think that a lot of it was challenged. I think that it was the best picture that we've had, particularly of the vice president's office, which is, in the secretive White House, a really tough nut to crack. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's hard to hard to penetrate. I think for reporters, it was a fascinating look at how some other reporters, those of us who weren't talking to Scooter Libby or, yeah. you know, who Scooter Libby didn't call, yeah. were like, uh-huh, interesting. You know, you saw the you saw the interactions, you saw the way that other reporters were working, you saw the deals of anonymity that some people yeah. were making.
Those seem to be unusual, particularly the one with Judy Miller, right. where she was taking his wish to be called a former Hill staffer, which I just can't imagine anybody.
I don't know anybody who thought that was I don't want to be, I don't want to castigate her too much, but I don't know anybody who would have done that. I mean, you work for, you know, sometimes you negotiate with people that you're dealing with, how you identify them. I have people in the administration, they want to be sometimes because it, particularly if it deals with another government, they don't want to be called the White House. They would be, they'd be called a U.S. official,
uh-huh.
which kind of spreads it out or something. Under the AP, AP rules for using anonymous sources, and it's a four-page set of rules. You know, you have to identify as closely as you can, and you have to be conscious all the time of these rules. You have to identify as closely as you can what kind of work this person does or something. So a U.S. official would be rare. I mean, our use of that term. But you have to negotiate sometimes because of the delicacy of stories, the ground rules. I would have never done anything that was misleading. I mean, that's that the one that you're talking about, a former Hill staffer, was it?
Yeah,
Hill staffer. I mean, that is technically right, but just patently wrong.
Mm-hmm. What kind of rules are there on anonymous sources?
I happen to bring them along here. Uh-huh. I could, let's see. The four basic rules are may be used only if the material is information and not opinion or speculation and is vital to the news report. The information is not available except under the conditions of anonymity imposed by the source. The source is reliable and in a position to have accurate information. And then it goes on to say that you know, reporters who intend to use material from anonymous sources must get approval from their news managers before sending the story to the desk. And before a news manager gives the approval to send a story to the desk, that you have to discuss with them, you have to reveal the source to your news editor.
Uh-huh.
So there, it's not like you can be the only person who knows. You have to talk with your news editor about who this person is, why they know this, why they're in a position to know this.
Mm-hmm.
And because on some stories that you're going to put out, you know, under urgent condition, there are people who think they have information. I mean, like when I'll go back to an example that burns in my memory, I think it was Howard Baker stood up on the Senate floor when Jim Brady, when there was an attempt on President Reagan's life in 1981, and Jim Brady, the press secretary, was shot in the head. And he got up on the floor of the Senate and said that Jim Brady had died.
Mm-hmm.
And it was because he had heard it either in the cloakroom or he heard it on a cable news or something. And so people were wanting to send urgents or a bulletin that Jim Brady had died, when obviously he did not.
Mm-hmm.
So you have to know. That's a case where somebody was on the record.
Uh-huh.
So you just imagine dealing with people on the background. You have to know, how do you know this? I mean, if it's something of importance, how do you know it? How do I know that you know it?
Mm-hmm.
I had that when Ronald Reagan died.
Mm-hmm.
I was driving through Rock Creek Park, and I got a call from a guy that I'd been working with on this for a long time. And he called me, and because going through Rock Creek Park, my cell phone died. But I, so I dash out of Rock Creek Park, and you know, and I get him, and he says, "Okay, you can go with it. He's died." I said, "You're sure?" He said, "Yep, pretty sure."
Pretty sure.
I said, "Pretty sure?" Right? It's like, hey, this is a, in fact, I said, this is a career ender if I'm wrong on this. Maybe a little overstatement, but, you know, yeah. It's, I regard it that seriously. And he said, well, let me make a phone call. I'll call you back. He called some people, and actually what had happened, there were a bunch of it, old Reagan people who had worked for the Reagan administration as advance team. They had been summoned earlier in the week secretly out to California to prepare for the Reagan funeral. And there were people, these are the people that he was talking to. And one of them had told him. So he called them, said, I've got, you know, I have to absolutely buy as a right. And he said, yeah, it's right. So he called me back and he said, okay, it's right. So I called the desk and I said, okay, I've got this bulletin. And I said, ABC just ran it like 30 seconds ago. So I was like, you know, a minute late.
30 seconds.
But by the time you go on the bulletin, it gets to the wire and everything. So I felt bad about being late on the one hand. And I think, you know, I've agonized a lot about whether I should have trusted the guy when he first called. Because he's a reputable person. But when he said, yeah, I'm pretty sure. It was like, whoa. Big slap.
Yeah.
So, you know, I think I had to stop and say, check.
Right. When you're preparing for a press conference, say the president's going to have a press conference, and he often will call on you as the first question. How do you put together your questions? And also when you're doing short question and answer sessions, Oval Office, you know, when he talks to a pool. Tell us about the whole process that you go through in deciding what you're going to ask and who you talk to.
Well, it's not a, you know, it's not a whimsical thing about going in and asking the president a question anytime. What we're looking for is an answer from him that will drive a story. That will be a, we're looking for something that is a compelling. Answer a compelling question, I guess, is the easiest way. Whatever is, you know, you look at what's in the news, and what is the most, sometimes it's the most, I think it's probably the most obvious question. What is on people's mind? And what is it that people are wondering about? Which way is the president going to go on this? Or, you know, there's been this terrible crisis, or, you know, Iraq is blowing up. What's he going to do? So what we're trying to do is go in there and get a clear start to a news conference, a newsy, hard news start to it. And we do the same, I mean, it's exactly the same thing that we do whenever you go into the Oval Office or anytime that there's an opportunity, anytime there's a possibility that there's going to be a question, we have a discussion. You know, and we'll discuss it among the four of us who work for the AP in at the White House. And on a big news conference, I'll talk to the bureau chief. You know, what's on your mind? What do you see out there? Because, you know, there are other people who have responsibility for the Hill or the Pentagon, and you know, you don't have your eyes on everything. And I'll frequently ask our State Department, hey, if you had a shot at Bush, what would you ask him today? And you know, and you kind of play with all these different ideas, and then you come up with something. I have to say that I don't think that they're terribly unique. You know that the people who work around the president, president's staff, they try to anticipate every question that reporters are going to ask. And they're pretty good at it. I mean, they're as good at figuring out what we're going to ask as we are in trying to figure out what a good, tough question is, because they don't want the president to be unprepared for a news conference.
That's so true, but you know that they vary greatly. Presidents, the last two presidents vary greatly in how they prepared for a news conference. That that Clinton did a lot more preparation than it appears that Bush does, for one.
Oh, and you talk about in preparation, when Ronald Reagan would have a news conference, mm-hmm. that would go on for like a week or two. Mm-hmm. I mean, they would make a decision that President Reagan would have a news conference in 10 days or something. And then the White House would send out queries to all the major agencies, say the president's going to have a news conference, what might come up on in your area, and what would he say in response? Mm-hmm. So they would draft a whole series of position papers that would start out with a question. They would boil those down. They sent them to Reagan. Mm-hmm. He would study them for a few days, mm-hmm. and then they would have rehearsals. They would have, like, he would do, like, maybe three rehearsals mm-hmm. for a news conference.
Yeah, because he took 2 days. It looks like on his schedule that he took 2 days out before press conference just to do the rehearsals and things.
To do that stuff. But the actual work involved in it mm-hmm. was much longer than that.
Right, yeah.
And, you know, I think that Bush 41 was more comfortable with news conferences. He came out into the briefing room, as you know, and he was a lot more frequent with news conferences. Mm-hmm. But also, and maybe you've discussed this in your class, the stakes seemed to be higher mm-hmm. back in the Reagan administration because they were practically all primetime news conferences.
They were, yeah.
And they were really high-stakes news conferences. It was a time when you had three channels. You didn't have 200 channels that people were looking at. So if anybody was watching television that night, you were watching a presidential news conference.
Right.
And, you know, I don't know what the numbers were, 60 million, 80 million. Mm-hmm. I mean, it was very daunting to be at a presidential news conference. I mean, to ask a question because, you know, America's looking at you.
Uh-huh.
So it was a big production,
uh-huh.
much less so now.
Would you have papers from around the country knowing that there was going to be a news conference then or now? Ask you about asking a question, could you ask him about this? Or do they do that on a regular basis just to get information? Do they ever ask you to ask the White House about something or other, one of your clients?
Very rarely. I don't think that would probably be, I don't know, in fact, Martha, I don't know that that's ever happened. You have interest groups that do that, and you have citizens who do that.
Yeah.
Particularly people who are unemployed and, you know, why don't you ask the president why won't he help people who are out of work or,
uh-huh.
you know, my unemployment benefits, why won't they extend the unemployment benefits? Ask him about that. That would be a big favor for me. Or, the Democrats, particularly in the Bush administration, would put out a list of, you know, five questions for Bush, which mm-hmm. almost kills those five questions because all of a sudden they're tainted. I mean, no reporter that I know could get up and ask those five questions
uh-huh.
since you look like
then
you're the mouthpiece for the Democratic Party.
Uh-huh. Would that come from interest groups?
Yeah. Uh-huh. No, interest groups will send you questions, political parties. You get an email, I'll bet twice a week, I don't know, maybe more, something about ask Bush this or Bush should answer this.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, everybody has these opposition research groups now,
right.
People who spend a lot of, you know, hours and they have a whole staff that just looks into things trying to find out something that could put the president on the spot.
Uh-huh.
So, I mean, there are people, but I don't think I've ever had one of the newspapers that takes the AP or radio or television station say,
mm-hmm.
would you ask, because, I mean, I think they know,
mm-hmm.
you know, it's, you know, thanks for the suggestion.
Yeah. What is the, what is the use for you of a news conference now, as opposed to during the Reagan years?
Well, it's the same as it is any time. I mean, a news conference is kind of a decision-forcing event. It puts the president on record about X or, you know, whatever you want to ask him about. You are making him commit, you're making him say, here's what we're going to do, or here's what our position is. things that are ambiguous or uncertain, or, you know, you just want to know what direction he's going in. It brings things to a conclusion sometimes. I mean, he can evade a question as easily as, if he wants to, he can sidestep stuff. But that's, you know, that's what I see the value in, is the president making a declarative statement about something that's uncertain, clearing something up or taking a position on something. That's where I think it, it puts the administration on record as here's where we stand.
In the press conference after the election, when the president announced that Rumsfeld was leaving, that it turned out that you and Steve Holland had an interview. Was Dick Kyle? I guess Dick Kyle
was there, right?
Of Reuters and Bloomberg. You all had met with him before the election, and you had asked him about Rumsfeld and whether Rumsfeld was going to stay to the end.
Right.
And what was his response?
I said, we were in the Oval Office. I think Dan Bartlett, the president's counselor, was the only other person there. And just because so much, you know, the Iraq War had gone so badly. And people have said from time to time, do you have confidence in Rumsfeld? And it was always yes. So I asked him, do you want Rumsfeld and Cheney to stay in your administration until the end? And he did he kind of evaded it with, you know, they're doing a great job. And I said, but do you want them to stay until the end? And he said, yes, I do. That's it. And and then Steve Holland followed up and said, let me just make sure I understand, which just pin him down a little bit more. He said, right. Rumsfeld, you want him to stay until the end? And Bush said yes. Mm-hmm. Unbeknownst to us, and we all went out and filed urgents that said Bush wants Rumsfeld to stay until the end of his administration. You know, Bush gave a job guarantee to Rumsfeld, one of the most controversial people in his administration or something. And then a week or 10 days later, he announces that he's not firing Rumsfeld. He's Rumsfeld leaving by agreement, and they've been talking about it for months.
And his when you asked about it, he said that he had given the misinformation because he wanted to go on to another question.
Well, I don't think he called it misinformation. He said, you know, I couldn't answer the question because it was right before the election, and, it could skew, you know, I didn't want to do something that would influence the election, which I was surprised at his answer, because presidents, Bush included, are so skillful at evading questions or brushing them aside or doing something. This was an unusual case in which he said something knowing that it was misleading.
Yeah.
That it was not a candid answer. It was a surprise to me to see him operate that way.
And what difference does it make now for when you talk to him?
Oh, I was just going to say, you know, Howie Kurtz, the media critic from the Post, called me up and wanted me to get into a judge the, you know. I thought, well, let's see, what's the margin in this for me? Calling the, I thought, well, no, this doesn't help me. So he said, do you think he lied to you? And I said, I took him at face value. I took him at his word. Which is true. I did take him at his word, and I think that's all you can do with a president. You know, you can push him a little bit, but what are you going to do? And it's, you know, going forward, you know, you're mindful of that experience that happened, you can try a follow-up, which we try, and Bush is very skillful at cutting off at times.
Yeah.
But you have to take a president at its word.
Mm-hmm. What about a press secretary, if you find that a press secretary is giving you misinformation?
Well, I think it calls into question the way you deal with a press secretary or how the weight that you attach to his statements. You know, sometimes press secretaries are not are sloppier than others. Say Scott McClellan, before he would do a news briefing, you couldn't get into his office for like 2 hours before he went out and did his briefing because he was in there like just studying his papers and underlining things and really. I think Tony Snow is a lot breezier about his preparation. I don't think that he puts the intensity into his preparation that Scott did. We had today, Tony Snow was in Mexico talking about this flap about the prosecutors being fired. And he told he came out and briefed the press, and then maybe 2 or 3 hours later, he had to come back and fix some of his statements. You know, well, she didn't put out a, Harriet Myers didn't put out a, didn't send an email. She said it verbally, and it wasn't a cabinet meeting. It was just with some Justice Department people. Mm-hmm. So he was having to kind of patch up what he what he said. But if he'd come, when he came out and said that, we didn't put any of it on the wire, actually, because it wasn't wire-worthy. I mean, it wasn't newsworthy. But if we had, we would have had it out there, and then we would have had to go back 3 hours later and correct it with what he said. So it's just, I mean, a different way of operation for press secretaries.
Right. One of the things, one of the benefits that Scott seemed to have is that while he would use the same phrase over and over again in a briefing, that phrase would usually come from the president.
Yeah, I think he was very careful about his homework. Tony's much more flippant. You know, his staff calls it the Tony Snow Show when he briefs. Scott, I don't think he went out there to give any kind of show. I think he went out to deliver what he had to deliver. He had a pretty fixed. He wasn't making things up on the podium or trying to be flashy. He went out there just to kind of. He had some information that he could disseminate or things he could talk about, and he stuck to those talking points pretty tightly.
One thing before we go to the students and they start asking
their students
you some questions.
Here?
Yes.
Oh, okay. Forgot about
just,
that.
Yes, just the internet away. I was wondering about your view of your role. Do you see yourself as a surrogate for the public? And do you have an image of somebody in your mind when you're going out and getting information and seeking to explain something? Do you have an image?
I do. Well, what I do, when I came to Washington, I mean, I've always thought that journalism was a fairly serious business. I mean, that you are you know, you're dealing with information can affect people's lives, affect people's reputations. You know, and in Washington, it seemed to me when I came here that it was more important than kind of the stories I've been writing about traffic accidents or, you know, whatever. And when I started covering the White House, I thought, this is really serious stuff. You know, there's no, and I tell the people who come to work for me at the White House, you know, there's no room for error here. You know, we've got to be right. This is, it's grown-up stuff. It's serious business. What you write is going to go all over the world. It's got, you know, wide impact, and you have to be first, and you have to be smart, and you have to be right, and you have to write it to the front page. You know, you have to write your way into newspapers because there's so much competition for space now. So do you think of yourself, I think of ourselves as kind of a reader's advocate. What do you want to know? You know, what is it about Washington? How important is this stuff? You know, you don't want to write rambling stories about things that nobody cares about. You want to, you know, we're dealing with important subjects. We're covering an important beat, one of the most important beats. It's one of the most competitive beats, I think, anywhere. So, you know, you put all those things together, and it adds a big weight on what you do. But I think that we feel that what I think all White House reporters feel this way, that you're doing stuff that you're writing a significant story that's going to attract a lot of attention. So you have to be careful, and you have to you just keep all these try to keep these things in your mind as you go about your business.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah. Thank you. Let's take some questions from the students. Somebody gonna chirp up there?
What do you do? You stare them down?
No, there's a professor in the classroom.
Oh.
I wonder if the thing's not working.
Do you read any blogs?
Oh, I read several blogs. I don't read a lot of blogs. I read a couple of media blogs to find out what's going on in my industry. I don't read political blogs because I read newspapers to give me a pretty good perspective on what's going on. I think of the blogs that I see are mostly things that I'm interested in. It's not things to enhance, to go further into politics or White House coverage.
Would it be things like policy, like economics, some economic blogs, or?
Oh no, I'm not that deep. Uh-huh. No, that's just, no.
There's
it's mostly entertainment because I mean, I look at I read the Times, the Post, and the Wall Street Journal every day.
That's what I was going to ask you. What you read?
So I read those three newspapers every day, and if I hear of something on another newspaper website, I'll go to that.
Uh-huh.
In the AP. The way our web page is set up, we've got like five newspapers that you just click on, mm-hmm. if you want to go see them. So there's only so much information that you can absorb or read. I guess you could sit there and read all day, but that's enough for me.
You read TV Newser?
No.
That's one that's. It's about the television industry.
And oh, I'm sure that the television correspondence.
It's the product of a student at Towson who's done it. Yeah,
I do look. I look at something called Media Bistro because
I think you can find it off of that.
It's is that right? It's a good right. Gossipy thing about the Washington news industry. Media.
Uh-huh.
So I enjoy that. I've recently, but I guess this isn't a blog site. I go to maybe once or twice a. Twice a week, maybe more. Go to Politico, the new political website.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
But that's about my involvement in blogs. I gave a talk at a university last year, and I asked the students. Somebody asked me about what I felt about blogs and how much I was influenced by blogs. And there were maybe about 125 students there at Franklin Pierce, and I said. Well, let me ask you, how many of you read blogs? And out of the 120 some, I would say maybe three kids raised their hands.
Huh.
So, I mean,
how about you all? How many of you all read blogs every day? And then tell me, because I can't see too well, what percentage of you are reading it?
None.
Zero.
What was the answer?
Zero.
All right. So, I know somebody's reading blogs. There are, because there are a lot of blogs. But.
What do you think Drudge's influence is, speaking of one blog?
I think that I know that a lot of people use Drudge as kind of a tip sheet, that they if something's breaking, if somebody had... He apparently monitors all the networks, all the different, yeah. A lot of news sites, and he'll throw something up, and people will say, "Did you see what's up on Drudge?" Drudge is not a place that I typically would go to.
Uh-huh.
What Drudge is most famous for now is breaking embargoes on embargoed presidential speeches, like mm-hmm. the State of the Union speech. And the president's speech about Iraq on January 10th, They send it in email to White House reporters about an hour before it's delivered, and you're not supposed to put it on any blog site or on the wire until the president starts speaking.
Mm-hmm.
And he broke that embargo by about as soon as he got it in email, he put it out on his uh-huh. internet site.
Uh-huh.
Which means as soon as it's up there, the embargo is lifted on everybody.
So, and
then he did the same thing again with the State of the Union. Mm-hmm. He broke the embargo.
Uh-huh.
So he's complicating life for the White House to that degree.
Uh-huh. Question?
Mr. Hunt, you said that Bush administration is very effective in controlling information. Do you think that future administrations are going to want to control just like the Bush administration?
You know, I think every administration wants a kind of an orderly process and wants to put out information according to its own schedule. Although there are people within the administration who have been more relaxed about talking, like in the Reagan administration, there was Jim Baker talked to reporters on background, and Mike Deaver did. The Clinton administration, there were many voices that talked. This administration has been a lot tougher. Or in the first Bush administration, there were more people who spoke. I think that any administration wants to be orderly and disciplined, but none have approached it with or have been as successful as this one has. Now, whether or not future administrations will be as disciplined. I didn't cover the Kerry campaign, but a reporter who did told me that he thought that they would be as tough for the media as the Bush administration has been. So, I don't know that we can tell at this point how another administration would be, but certainly this one has earned a reputation as being tough.
Mm-hmm.
Have you gone through that?
Dan has spoken a couple of times with students.
Dan Bartlett.
And he has said to them that the difference that he sees between Democrats and Republicans, this was in the first term, was that and the beginning of the second term, that Democrats are like day traders. And they're like long-term investors. Republicans are long-term investors. And they really want to, they think through what they're going to do and what they're going to say. And that whereas the Democrats play on a daily cycle and react to what things are coming. And so he said that he recognized that the Democrats were much better at responding quickly to things. It took them a much longer time to do it. In an interview at the end of the year, near the end of the year, he was talking about how his views had changed on that. He brought up the subject and said that that he really thinks it has to be a hybrid, that you can't just talk about those things that you want to talk about, and that you do have to respond.
Well, I think you saw the responsiveness today in Mexico, where there is this, the president has his own agenda down in Latin America. Well, it has been completely overshadowed today about this flap about the firing of the prosecutors. And so they schedule all of a sudden a televised briefing with Dan Bartlett at 4 o'clock. And he comes out and starts talking about the president's agenda in Latin America, knowing that every question that follows is going to be either about the fired prosecutors or about what Pete Pace, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs, said about gays in the military. So, I mean, everything was completely off topic, but they know that they had to deal with all of these issues to diffuse them as much as they can. Because they don't control the message as much as they used to with a Democratic-controlled Congress.
Yeah.
With a Republican Congress, they were able to control the message pretty effectively. But now, there's another big voice in Washington.
Do you think, in a way, that having that kind of control is be careful what you wish for? that that yes, you get to talk about what you want to, but at the same time, you don't listen and you don't hear things that are going to be important to your administration, problems that are out there that that if you were a little more open, you would find out about and you could catch at an earlier stage.
I think the Democrats would say that they were there for 6 years trying, you know, knocking on the door, trying to trying to be heard, but didn't find much of a willing ear. You know, I think it's obviously it's better to to have a bunch of voices. That's what it's what we try to do in stories. You know, you just don't want to have a singular.
Right.
Here's what the president said. You know, you try to have give some perspective with the different voices, you know, but, you know, there's the anti-war movement or there's the Democrats or there's the, you know, here's what the international community thinks about this.
Yeah.
So that it's you know, it's not so one-sided.
Mm-hmm. One thing that I wanted to ask you that
it's supposed to be their turn.
Just let me get this one in.
Okay.
And that is when you do off-the-record sessions, or let's say reporters do off-the-record sessions.
If there were.
Yeah, if there were such a thing as off-the-record sessions with the president, what are the value of those sessions? What do you find, say, for example, on recent presidents? How are they different in those sessions than they are, say, in a press conference?
They say things that they don't say in a press conference.
Mm-hmm.
But it's, you know, it's if you play by the rules, it's frustrating because a president will say something in a off-the-record session that is, you know, nominally what it's intended to do is show you, you the reporter, what the president's like and what he's really thinking. But if you know, you're constrained and you can't do anything with it, it's frustrating.
Mm-hmm.
I've had a president tell me that, you know, I'll tell you this, but if you ask me this at a press conference, I'll fluff you on it.
Mm-hmm.
That, you know, I wouldn't give you this kind of answer. I'll give you a different kind of answer.
Mm-hmm.
It does give you, it does inform you, though, about what's on, what he's really thinking. So that you could, when you're writing, maybe cast some doubt or emphasize something or know to look for this voice to bring into a story just as a, you know, here's something that is, you know, possible. And, you know, it's one of those things that reporters like to do and I like to have, but at the same time, you know, you're so constrained by, if you play by the rules, and, you know, I think it's important to do that if you're going to do this, if you're going to have an off-the-record session with the president.
Yeah.
I've been in situations where reporters wouldn't go in and talk to the wouldn't do an off-the-record session with the president just because they felt that it compromised them.
Yeah.
And that, but having said that, you know, I've always had in the back of my mind that if I were in a off-the-record session with the president and he said something that was so compelling or so outrageous or something, you know, you have to say, stop, you know, either You've got to put that on the record, or I'm going to leave, or I can't because I'm going to have to develop this story. And every one that I've been in, I've always tried to get some of it.
Mm-hmm.
Would you mind if we went back, and that thing you said about, you know, so and so? Would you put that on the record, or you know, at least as an administration official, because if it's really off the record, it's off the record, which means you can't use it at all.
Yeah. Can you use it to try to go get somebody else to say it?
Well, see, that's the same kind of cheating. That
no.
I mean, you shouldn't.
Okay.
But there might be somebody. Everything, you know, it's the whole, the integrity of, you know, all you have is your integrity and your reputation and dealing with them and dealing with the public. So, you know, you don't want to jeopardize that.
William Price, who was an early correspondent at the White House in the 19th century.
I don't think I go back that far.
Yeah. Well, he talked about during the Theodore Roosevelt administration, where they had few of them had regular access to the president, and it was off the record. And if you were to break the rules, you would be in deep trouble, and you wouldn't be asked to come to any sessions again. So he said that he was in a terrible position because he could get information from somewhere else, and somebody may have given him something.
Oh, well, then you shouldn't. Then I wouldn't feel bound by it.
And he still couldn't use it because he said he couldn't risk having Roosevelt think that he had gotten it, you know, from him and had used it. So he found that he couldn't use it.
You have to tell people that you're dealing with, particularly when you're dickering about news or negotiating about news, that, you know, we've got other reporters who are pursuing this story, and, you know, I'm bound by these rules, but if they get it from a Hill source or they get it somewhere else, you know, we're not going to hold it up. Mm-hmm. They have their own thing. Mm-hmm. You know, talking about previous presidents, I read this book by a predecessor of mine, a guy named Frank Cormier, who covered Lyndon Johnson. And he talked about being on the plane when Johnson came back. And at that time, everything that was said on Air Force One was off the record. And Johnson was trying to curry favor with these reporters, and he was saying that, you know, I want you all to be invested in my administration. I want you to be invested in my success. If I'm successful, you'll be successful. I'll tell you things I won't tell my cabinet. I'll tell you everything. I'll lay it out on the line with you. You know, if you'll play ball with me, I'll play ball with you, and, you know, I'll give you great stories, but you have to be committed to, mm-hmm. you know, to the success. And he said, and, you know, you can report anything. He said, now, I may wander into a strange bedroom every now and then, and you can't report that, but, you know, practically everything else.
Uh-huh.
And this is in Frank Cormier's book about Lyndon Johnson talking to him that way. Mm-hmm. And the reporters, like, demurred or wouldn't make any kind of commitment. Or mm-hmm. And obviously they didn't sign on to that kind of thing.
Right.
But, the president would expect people to keep something like that secret, which they did on a daily basis. I mean, nobody went off and said, you know, Johnson said...
Yeah.
I may wander into a strange bedroom from time to time.
Uh-huh. Cormier also had an experience with Johnson where Johnson got angry with him over a story.
Right.
And it wasn't a story that Cormier thought that, you know, was... that he couldn't understand why he'd gotten upset with it. But anyway, Johnson had made it clear that he was upset about it. It was around Christmas time. And at Christmas, the president used to give reporters, those who covered the president on a regular basis, would give them a Christmas gift. And this particular year, it was cufflinks. Did you heard about
it? No, I hadn't heard that story. No, he must have been mad at him another time.
he gave out cufflinks to the... Oh, no, it was a tie. It was a tie clasp that had the presidential seal on it. And... So he opened up his box, and his box was empty. And he laughed because he knew. He said that there was no accident. He knew that Johnson had ordered that.
Well, Johnson had in the Oval Office. He had two wire machines, the old wire tickers.
Yeah.
He had an AP and a UPI thing, and he would get up from the turn around and go back. This is before my time, but I've read about it. He would go back and read the wire, and if there was something that he didn't like. Mm-hmm. He would just pick up the phone and call Cormier or call Merriman Smith, the UPI guy, and bawl him out.
Yeah, yeah. I think Cormier said that that he came back.
Oh yeah, yeah.
Well, and there are wonderful pictures of Johnson where he's pulling the copy out, and it's not coming out the top. He's pulling it out before it comes to the top. You know, where he's on his knees looking at it. Another question.
When the Rumsfeld question, did that change your opinion on personal character, or did you find that he was, and since that event, have you found found yourself doubting his sincerity?
It was hard to hear the question. So
on the question of that you asked
Rumsfeld,
about,
right?
About Rumsfeld,
right.
And how has it affected how you deal with him and your views of his sincerity?
Well, I think what I said before. You have to take a president at face value at what he says. You know, there's very, we do truth squad what presidents say, but if he says, you know, I want somebody to stay and I'm not going to fire somebody, and then 2 days later they fire him, there's nothing you can do. As to how I personally feel, you know, I feel strangely kind of detached from that, about the way I feel about a president. Yeah, I try not to be judgmental. I've got, just in terms of newspapers, I've got 1,500 newspapers out there that are my editors, because, you know, they look at my copy, and if I swung one way or the other way or something, there would be, you could bet that there would be people who would be complaining about it, that and you wouldn't last long in this job, you know, and I've lasted a long time. So I don't try to make a personal judgment about a president's integrity. I can be surprised by something that happens, but I don't try to let that influence or impact the way that I deal with it, because I have to deal with these people. I mean, I have to deal with the president and his staff as long as they're there. So. Yeah, I may talk, and I have talked to members of this administration about different things involving issues like what you're talking about. That's kind of a little vague, but I don't make a public display about it, and I don't, I don't want it to influence what I write.
Mm-hmm. Do you try to say before a president comes in? Do you try to kind of get into his head, get some sense of how he thinks?
Oh, sure, yeah.
And how do you do that?
I think it's the only way you do it. It's by, you try to you report on them, you get out, you follow them around, you see how they respond to different things, you know, you see how they are when they're angry, when they're happy, when things go well, when things don't go well. You see if an administration stutters when something happens, or you see how efficiently they deal with problems, and you just, you know, I don't pretend to be a shrink. I know some people are, you know, pretty good at that, but it's helpful to just try to gather as much string, mm-hmm. color, information as you can about a president before you mm-hmm. start covering. And the way that most of that happens is dealing with people in a campaign before they get to the White House, and then once they're in the White House, I mean, which is a huge pressure cooker. Mm-hmm. It is because then they're dealing with real crisis in real time. You see how people react, and you know that's part of your story. I mean, you don't want to have a plastic figure when you write about the president. You know, mm-hmm. you're writing about a person, and people deal with him as a person. Bush has been remarkably effective, I think, in projecting kind of the backyard over a mm-hmm. backyard barbecue kind of image with people that has helped him. And you know, in person, he's a he's a likable guy. He's mm-hmm. very, you know, he's funny. He's a lot of wisecracks and stuff. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. He seems to be pretty much like that person that mm-hmm. he projects to be, a guy who likes to talk to what he'd call real people.
Mm-hmm.
If you look at the way he chooses to spend his time in Washington, it certainly is not going out to parties and to gatherings, to dinners. Maybe he would go out to his sister's house or to, you know, a friend's house. But
very little, very rare. He is one of the most, not anti-social, but he is not a social president. He is mm-hmm. not, He does not go, he doesn't do the Georgetown circuit or the Embassy Row. His father used to go out to a Chinese restaurant in mm-hmm. Northern Virginia, Peking Duck. Mm-hmm. This president hardly ever goes out. In fact, you sometimes wonder, what does he do in there all the time? Mm-hmm. He has this, not secrecy, but I mean privacy, I guess, and mm-hmm. that people come and go all the time that we don't know about. He has people up to Camp David when he goes up there. He has friends yeah. who come in. And he is, he's supposed to be a very social guy, and I'm sure that he has a lot of people who come in and see him at the White House, but we don't know who they are. We don't know what happens in there. Mm-hmm. I mean, basically, when he leaves the Oval Office and goes over to the residence, mm-hmm. well, we think he exercises. He says that he exercises for an hour. Mm-hmm. But, I mean, the people that he sees at night. But, Clinton was the same way. Clinton had, Clinton was much more social.
Yeah. He used to go out to dinner.
Right. Clinton yeah. He used to drive people crazy. He went out to dinner so much.
Yeah.
But at the same time, Clinton had a lot of people in who we never knew about. I remember when he was looking for a Supreme Court justice, he had Bruce Babbitt in, who was the Interior Secretary. Mm-hmm. And he called Babbitt up one night about midnight and said, come on over. Mm-hmm. And I found out about and Babbitt stayed until 2 o'clock and walked out at 2 o'clock in the morning thinking that he was the next Supreme Court justice. Uh-huh. And I found out about it the next day, and I went to Joe Lockhart, who was the press secretary, and I said, what did Bush tell Babbitt? And he said, Babbitt wasn't here. Mm-hmm. And he went through the, he talked to people, and he came back and said, no, he wasn't here. Mm-hmm. Because nobody knew except, some Secret Service people and Clinton. Right. Yeah. But he hadn't talked to the chief of staff about it, and he hadn't talked to anybody else about it. Uh-huh. So, I mean, presidents have got this great... And, as public as it is, they have a lot of privacy within the in the residence.
Yeah. A question?
Yeah. How do you decide which scandals to report on, which are real on, which are by just partisan fighting?
Do you want to decipher that?
Yeah. You're gonna have to try that again. Maybe. Do you think they should stay, be further away from, or closer? Get closer. Get closer to the microphone.
How do you decide which scandals to report on? Which are real and which are just partisan?
Which scandals to report on?
Which ones are partisan? Which are just a partisan a dig, and what things are real? How do you know, a real scandal from something that the opposition is just trying to dish out?
Well, practically every scandal that I can think of starts small. It doesn't, Watergate started with a dismissive burglary and, it developed into something within a matter of days because actually an AP reporter found out that there was a White House connection to the people who were arrested. So that kind of picked up a bit. Iran-Contra, which was a scandal during the Reagan administration, selling arms to Iran in hopes of getting out the hostages. They all start out small. So and there are things. There are going to be people who you're right that in Washington, probably an opposition group is trying to. Whip up a scandal about maybe every week. But these things develop legs on their own if enough heat and mass gather and enough people politically get involved and talk about it, foment it, and the administration finally has to respond to it. There are things that come and die out pretty quickly and things that are ignored completely. But... I don't know.
But if you look at like Jack Abramoff, the Abramoff scandal, then there was one that really developed legs because there were just so many different people who were involved in it.
Yeah, but partisans will try to make a scandal or a case mm-hmm. out of anything, mm-hmm. and it's hard to give definition to what makes a real scandal. I mean, I think there are a lot of things that don't rise to a big scandal. We're pretty sparing in the word, in the use of the word scandal, because you know, as you might suggest, there are a lot of things that people want to make into scandals and really aren't. So it's just the seriousness of the charge, the people who are involved, the players on both sides. It rises to a level, and that's, you know, you know it's like pornography. You know it when you see it. According to the Supreme Court, was it Hugo Black or?
It was Potter Stewart.
Potter Stewart. Okay.
But say in Abramoff, there were a lot of people that were being investigated, for prosecution.
Federal investigations help. Jail time helps. You know, give definition to a scandal.
Yeah, and then they're high up.
Yeah,
and they're members of Congress, and then members of the administration. Yeah, that will do it. You got something else? Let's have two more questions.
Is it easier job in a period of divine?
Get close to the microphone.
Is it easier to do your job in a period of divided government?
It probably is more, it has fuller disclosure in a period of divided government, because you have more of a check and balance on, you have people pulling back the curtain and looking, exposing things, questioning. You know, reporters there can only go so deep into the White House. There, you can't file a Freedom of Information Act at the White House. That their stuff is protected. It's not like a, you know, you can file a Freedom of Information Act somewhere else. But members of Congress, which have oversight over the White House, they can look into a White House budget. They publish the salaries of everybody who works in the White House. They can call administration witnesses, cabinet secretaries, put them on the spot and grill them about things if they want to. In a period of unified government, where they have, they're not as inclined to embarrass the administration, you're not going to get as much. And I think that you're seeing some of that right now in the first 3 months of this Democratic administration, that they are, the members of Congress, the congressional committees, are calling members of the administration up, and making them explain things. I don't think that you would have seen this thing today about the prosecutors, mm-hmm. If the Republicans were in control. You would see Democrats complaining about it, but with no leverage actually to do anything about it.
Another question?
Well, the presidents, which are the most important?
Well, it's hard to measure people off the record. Let me take out that piece. I mean, Clinton was a fascinating president to cover, just because he is kind of like a fraternity house kind of White House. They knew no hours. They groggily got started about 9 o'clock, and then they would go until, 11, 12, midnight. And when the president was traveling, you were up until 2 o'clock or anything. And, as you saw, he was quite a character. I mean, he was a policy wonk. He was he's a very smart guy. He was a riveting speaker. Reagan, as a former Hollywood actor, could mesmerize crowds. He was a... he could bring people to tears. He was a great, this is trite, great communicator. This president, because he's got a war going on, he's got two wars going on, demands a lot of attention, gets a lot of attention. He's very aggressive. He's got a very muscular foreign policy. He's unlike the previous presidents that I've covered. He really doesn't seem to care too much about what world opinion or other leaders think, that he's going to go ahead and do things his way. So, you know, everybody's got kind of, and, you know, his father, Gulf War. I mean, they're all amazingly interesting characters. Books are, you know, countless books are going to be written about every one of them. And, you know, I wouldn't want to just separate off the record part. You've got to take, you know, the whole picture of the people. And, you know, from my perspective, there's not a more fascinating thing in the world to do than cover the president.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Thank you very much, Terry.
Well, thank you, Martha. I appreciate being out. Thanks for everybody sitting there and listening to me for an hour and a half.
Well, thank you.